Welcome to the Humanosphere podcast. My name is Tom Paulson. I'm publisher, founder, and executive editor and janitor at humanosphere.org, where we cover the fight against poverty and inequity because we give a damn. For today's podcast, we're going to be talking with Samuel Ledesmo, hope I'm saying that right, who started an organization in northern Kenya called the Pastoralist Child Foundation. It's a community organization that aims to put an end to the practice of female genital mutilation, which is still fairly high in countries like Kenya. It's gone down overall in the country from 38% in 1998 to about 21% in recent years, but that's still very high. And we're talking with Samuel about his work in a part of the country where it's almost 95% of the girls who suffer this procedure around puberty. So we're going to talk about that. It's an unpleasant reality, which we do sometimes talk about unpleasant realities, not just the pleasant realities. But before we get to that, I am going to talk with our chief correspondent, Tom Murphy, who lives somewhere in the woods in the East Coast. And we're going to talk about some of the highlights, the news highlights this week in the Humanosphere. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
So one story that I was interested in was by Joanne Liu, and she was bouncing off a study done by the Imperial College London, a team there, looking at lifespan and how in most countries lifespan is going up. It's going up faster for women in many countries, and she especially focused on South Korea, which is being predicted to, in the near future, have the longest lived women, and so for their life expectancy to get above 90 years thanks to healthier lifestyle, equitable health care, and so forth. One of the things Joanne noted in that study, which is always worth mentioning, is that the United States ranks fairly poorly on health overall. And on life expectancy, we're down in the middling range, even though we're the wealthiest country in the world. And according to this study, our life expectancy is actually going down, which is unusual for the Western world. So it's kind of that's a good news, bad news story.
I wonder why is that not more embarrassing to the United States? Like, where are all the headlines saying our life expectancy is declining, and despite all of the great things that we have, that we perform so terribly on this?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. This kind of finding comes out every year, and, you know, in some fashion or another, and it's our health indicators in general in this country are pretty poor. We have fairly high child mortality rates. I mean, we're equivalent to almost third world countries in terms of that. And you know, why is that the case? I think it's probably, many people believe it's due to inequitable access to health care and poverty, the gap between the rich and the poor. So I don't know why we don't pay more attention to it. Maybe because we don't want to pay attention to the root causes, which, you know, we have a country that is obviously very divided politically, but it's also very divided in terms of quality of life. So I don't know why people aren't more upset about it. It's pretty stunning statistics. So we should just move to South Korea. That's the point of that study. They live a lot longer.
Sounds a nice place.
And they, you know, have those fun Gangnam style dances. So I wanted to have you talk about a couple of stories that you did that I think were sort of in the world politics realm. One was you wrote about the opposition to the Trump administration's proposal to boost military spending by 10% and to cover the cost of that, cutting things like the State Department by a third and foreign aid by a third or 40%. Tell us a little bit about that proposal and how it was received.
So the short story is that the Trump administration wants to spend more on defense, and they're going to pay for it by cutting the rest of the government. And it's not just like a little trim. It's pretty deep cuts. The latest figures that we've seen are 39% cut for the State Department, which is where the U.S. Agency for National Development falls. So basically the foreign aid budget is going to be, if it were to be accepted, which I think is like has a major asterisk, would fall by more than a third, which would, you know, hearkening back to in 2011, Raj Shah appeared before Congress because, and Raj Shah was the head of USAID at that time, because there were going over with cuts to the budget. And at that point, they were going to cut the budget by, it was like 16 or 19%. And he said at that point that a 19% cut to funding would lead to 70,000 more deaths. That's calculated like life saved by programs that mostly through malaria, a few things through maternal and child health. And so we budget a little bit less than it was in 2011, but not that far different. And the cut is twice as big. So this is, man, this is just, and that's a taste of the impact, let alone the fact that the opposition, which is coming from everybody from the likes of Oxfam to Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, are saying you're going to do more harm than good by cutting our development and diplomacy side, because those are important things for national security. Not even just, you know, helping people around the world. It's in our interest to have countries be doing better.
No. It's, so anyway, what's interesting is it did get a pretty negative reaction. So it may not happen. Somebody, I forget who it was, in Congress, one of the Republicans said the budget proposal is dead on arrival. Anyway, so
yeah, that was like McConnell or something. One of those guys. Maybe not him, but yeah.
Yeah, and then. Another story you run that's somewhat related to the Trump effect, if we can call it that, on foreign aid and development, is a story you wrote about how the Global Fund for AIDS to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria is having trouble finding a new executive officer.
Yeah, so the current head, Mark Dybul, said that he was only going to serve one term, which ends at the end of April. So the process to find his replacement started in this past fall. They whittled down a bunch of potential candidates, the Global Fund did, to three finalists, and basically everything fell apart. And in large part, it is, in fact, because of the fact that Trump has come into office. The United States provides a third of the budget. Like, we literally peg one third. So what everyone else provides, we will then go one third of that total. And so we need to please the Global Fund needs to please the new administration. And so one of the candidates had tweeted some potentially negative things about Trump, and there were some other concerns about how he might feel about, say, like the Helen Clark, the Prime Minister of New Zealand. And so that, in part, in addition to a very messy and terrible and leaky process that actually in some ways reflects the way the Trump administration has been working right now. There's a leak of the way that everyone was ranked to the New York Times. They announced, instead of picking one of the three, that they're starting all over again.
Yeah. So a lot of confusion out there thanks to this new
administration. Yeah, and in a very similar way, you know, this week was also a rather rushed conference held to fill the funding gap on on family planning because of the reinstatement of the Mexico City policy or the global gag rule, which mm-hmm. restricts groups to work on or advise about abortions. And so we're seeing this is a whole range of potential impacts, whether we're talking about budget, to actual impacts when we're talking about things like the gag rule and the Global Fund that are already starting in a barely month-old administration.
Yeah. So it's hopefully people will pay attention to it, and we're not going to end up making all these changes for political grandstanding that actually do cost lives. I mean, that's the thing people need to realize. These things aren't just abstract issues. This is life and death in many cases. And
one thing I want to point out too, which is, I think, is like one of the most unfortunate outcomes, and this is, I think, is even a broader issue within the way the discussions are going right now, is that when you have these diametrically opposed sides, when you have like a side that's like make big cuts, the reaction on the other side is save the money, so save mm-hmm. the aid budget. And you know, the work that we are looking at and doing at Humanisphere is really in that middle space, which is saying that this is important, but there are it is not perfect. There are things that work great, and there are things that fail.
Yeah.
And I think that like we are really missing out on an opportunity to see better foreign aid when the conversation is only about cutting versus just keeping the money. And the same thing goes for like whether it was the UN or whatever these things are. These are you know, not really helping actual policy.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It's hard to, I mean, there's been a lot of push to improve the way we do this, and now it's just shoring up and trying to prevent things from collapsing. So it's not a, doesn't foster improvement and progress.
No.
Yeah, and one last thing I just wanted to take note of was a couple stories, actually. The main one by Lisa Nichol, again, bouncing off a study. The headline is Men and Children Make Up a Larger Percentage of Human Trafficking Victims. And she's bouncing off a study done at the University of Southern California, which showed that the amount of, I mean, there's a tremendous number of people who are trafficked and put into forced labor, according to the United Nations, more than 20 million people last time they studied it in 2012. And of course, a lot of what gets attention on this is sex trafficking, but a lot of it's labor, a lot of it's child labor, and so forth. And so at any rate, the point of the story is that women, who have made up the majority of the world's human trafficking victims, and they still do, but the number of men and children who are being trafficked has been increasing. And so, you know, it's a change that, and it's not sure people in Lisa's article speculate why this may be the case, but I think the takeaway point there is that there's still many millions of people who are put into forced labor around the world, and it's actually a lot bigger than people realize. Anyway, so those are the Humanosphere highlights, headlines from the week. And Tom, I appreciate you coming into the office virtually to have a discussion about that, and, you know, doing a great job. And like you said, we, you know, I point to people, go to the website, look at the Save the Humanosphere banner at the top and donate. Keep us going. Journalism is very important, always has been, but I think people are getting on how much more important it is these days. So support independent journalism and support Humanosphere. And now we are going to get to our guest, who's being interviewed by, who was our London correspondent, London-based correspondent, Charlie Insor, who's now based in Nairobi. And Charlie is going to be talking with Samuel Ledesma, who is the founder of a community organization in Northern Kenya called the Pastoralist Child Foundation. And he's working to end female genital mutilation in that community. And so we're going to hear Charlie's interview with Samuel shortly. So thanks, Tom. Thanks for chiming in on the headlines.
Thanks for having me on. Always great to join you from the woods of New England.
Hello, and welcome to our latest podcast, live from Samburu County in Kenya. Today, I'll be speaking to Samuel Sereria Ledesma, founder and director of the Pastoralist Child Foundation, an organization which works with the Samburu tribe to end harmful FGM practices. Female genital mutilation, also known as FGM, is the ritual removal of some or all of the external female genitalia. The practice is found in Africa, Asia, and in the Middle East. Since 2012, Samuel and the Pastoralist Child Foundation have been working to eradicate FGM and forced early marriages in the community. The rate of FGM in the county, in particular, is quite high, with around a 95% prevalence rate among young girls and women in the community. So the challenge of eradicating FGM, particularly in Samburu and Maasai tribes, is particularly difficult. Despite Kenya banning the harmful practice in 2011, high prevalence rates still endure. The practice of FGM is deeply embedded into culture, and it forms many parts of tradition. For many young girls, the procedure marks her passage into womanhood, and any attempts to stop the procedure from occurring can result in a perceived loss of honour and of social isolation. The Pastoralist Child Foundation provides a model that is community-led, providing educational workshops that focus on FGM, child marriage, teen pregnancy, HIV and AIDS, gender-based violence, health and sanitation, and the importance of formal education. So by giving young girls an education on their sexual and reproductive rights, the approach aims to return these rights to girls. So FGM is often used as a process of controlling women's sexuality and is rooted around ideas of purity, modesty, and beauty. So without further ado, I was wondering if you could introduce the charity, how you founded it, mm-hmm. and your background yourself within the community.
Mm-hmm. So actually, Pastoral Shalt Foundation was founded in 2012 when one of the white lady, which is the president of the Pastoral Shalt organization, Saida Garrett, visited Samburu County to see her own favorite animal, an elephant. So while she's staying in the lodge, she visited our village. When she came back to the lodge, she called me, "Someone come here, let me show you the photos of the village, of Samburu people." So when I saw the photos, actually I saw my aunties, my stepbrother, my dad. Then Saida was so excited because she didn't think that people back at the lodge they are also staying at the village. For me, I had in 2011 I had the idea of starting a community-based organization to eradicate FGM. I approached Saida Garrett to see how she can be able to help me fulfill the idea I have of saving the girls in Samburu community. Saida was ready to help me when she went back to US, New Jersey. She emailed me immediately that register the organization as a community-based organization. She will help me because she's well-connected in US. So immediately when I registered Pastoral Shalt Foundation, she also in 7 months later she registered also as a 501c3, a charitable organization, whereby immediately we started to fundraise some money through Indiegogo and the global giving. So we received about $3,000. Sometime we received $2,000. So we started to sponsor girls, to show the community that education is so important. Then in some month again, we started a girls' workshop to empower them about FGM, child marriage, reproductive health, hygiene and sanitation, self-awareness, HIV and AIDS. So as we proceed, so the county government saw that Samuel is doing an incredible job, and we need to see how we can be able to recognize his effort to eradicate FGM in Samburu County. So I received that recognition certificate. 1 year later, also the Anti-FGM Board through UNICEF Kenya and the Gender Directorate, they also recognized what I'm doing. Then they invited Pastoral Shalt Foundation to be one of the UN joint program. Then in few months again, UNICEF Kenya decided to fund Pastoral Shalt Foundation. They gave us a grant of $50,000 to cover 6 villages to educate them about FGM, child marriage, leadership, and reproductive health. Then from there also, Girl Generation joined UNICEF to support us to educate girls during holidays, because during the holidays, that's the time that girls are in danger in Samburu community. We started to empower 70 girls every holiday, the holiday for August, April, and December. Then in 1 year ago, we saw there's a need of us also to educate boys. So every holiday now, we educate both boys and girls because we believe in a collective responsibility.
And could you speak about your own personal story? What made you look at your community around you and think this needs to change, FGM needs to stop?
Yeah, actually for me, I am a diploma holder in hospitality management. So when I was in the college, when I finished my college in 2009, so when I came back to the community, I saw there is a lot of teen pregnancy in the community, and the community are cutting girls annually without recognizing their health, without recognizing that girls can. So I had the idea of changing the community and help our girls grow. Because those girls, they want to be doctors, nurses, community health workers, to help the community. So that's what motivated me to come back to my community and help them to stop FGM and focus on importance of education.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And how difficult has it been to convince your community that FGM is harmful to women and young girls?
Actually, we know it is very, very hard to convince Samburu community to stop FGM because it's part of the culture. So for me, I saw the best way I can use is first to tell the community about the importance of education. So I said, let me first show the community about the importance of education by sponsoring girls, taking them to school. From there, when the community show that I have that power to sponsor girls and take them to school, I now intervene to tell them to what are the effects of FGM. So when I ask the elders the effect of FGM, elders told me, sir, we don't know. You know, we are not the one who has cut. Go and ask the women. So I had that big challenge because community are saying, oh, you want to come and change our culture. Sometimes also I get dread from my fellow warriors and the community as well that you want to change my culture, you want to change the Samburu culture. So for me, being at the grassroots level, the first instant, I was not worried about how the community will take me. But I said I must find a way of using do not harm approach, because staying with the community at the village, telling them about the effect of FGM, that it's not an insult, but some people take it as an insult to change the culture. So what I did, I meet elders in person, 5 to 6 elders, and tell them more about FGM, where the FGM started. Like I usually tell them FGM started in Egypt. During the time of King Pharaoh. So he finds the way of how to punish women. So they say the only way that they can punish women is to cut their genital. So he called the women in masses. So then they cut the women's genital and put on the basket. So when they put on the basket, so he took all those genitals and put on the River Nile. So from there, they believe that the rain will rain, and then the crop will get enough water, then the people will get food. So when I tell them as well to tell us the history about the FGM in Samburu, most of the elders, they don't know. Even they say that we circumcise our girls because of marriageability, and as well the girls to be clean and also to perform some rituals. So that's what they believe. You know, if you are uncircumcised, you are not supposed to perform some ritual in Samburu community. If you are uncircumcised, you are not supposed to be married in Samburu community. So I started to tell them the long-term effect of FGM. So without actually do not harm. So that's why now I'm staying with the community, and they are ready completely to listen to me without any harm. But at the beginning, I used to get SMS threats.
Is this something that women, young girls, haven't spoken about before in the community? If you look at some of the side effects of FGM, which are quite horrific, they include recurrent infections, difficulty urinating and passing blood during periods, chronic pain, development of cysts, and infertility and complications during childbirth. Are these things that you feel that women and girls in the community now are speaking out about more? And because men and boys are now involved in talking about the intricacies of women's health, that there's more understanding and more sympathy, perhaps?
At the beginning, women fear to speak about themselves. They fear. Even if you bring women and elders together, they won't at the beginning. But at the moment now, the women, some of the women, let me say 30% of the women in Samburu, they can now speak more about themselves. As we know, Samburu is one of the most deprived areas in terms of services. Mm. So when you go at the grassroots level there, some of the women fear to speak because elders, they are the decision makers. So in case you want to change something in the community, involve elders. So, but in some places, you see the women can speak for themselves. And like when I had the community dialogue with women and the elders together, the women can speak while they are here and the elders are there. The women are willing to speak about the effect, what they are going through. But there's some instances, there's those elders who are very arrogant. They will tell women, if you continue speaking, we will curse you. So there are still those challenges the women are getting in terms of speaking for themselves in our community.
So how many girls and young women do you say you've reached in Samburu and among Maasai tribes?
Yeah, so actually now I have reached 540 girls so far in our educational workshop for 4 days. So in every year I reach 210 girls. 210 girls every year. So in terms of community, we have reached more than 6,000, both women and elders, to educate them. We are using door-to-door community dialogue and also the Barasa, telling them about the effect of FGM, child reproductive health, etc., etc.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the successes you've seen so far? Not just the prevention in terms of access to education, health education, realization of rights.
The first success I saw, the community now accepting the girls to go to undergo the passage of rights in our educational workshop. When I started, they were not allowing girls to sign those agreements that I want to be circumcised. So, but currently now, whenever the girls go to the workshop, every year we have the passage of rite, whereby I'll call the parent of the girls, both the mothers and their fathers. I'll call them at school, telling them what I taught the girls. Then from there, they all agree. So the passage of rite is one of the success thing I've seen, because the parent now are allowing girls to say, I want to be cut until I will finish my school. You know, when now they finish the high school, the girls will speak for themselves. And one of the success stories also, there is one girl we have rescued, and she's one of our sponsored girls. She's now in grade 12. She'll finish high school this year. So we went to their home, so she was not ready to be circumcised. Then I told her, let me help you to take you to school. Then tell your parent you'll be circumcised later. You know, we are trying to use techniques, because when the girl grow, she will now speak for herself.
Sure.
That's one of the success I've seen, because the girl now, she's uncut, she's now in grade 12, she'll join the university next year, and no one now will be able to tell him, we will circumcise you, because the girl now will speak for herself. Two, also the community perception. You know, when I talk about education, perception about the education and FGM, the community now, they have realized that for us to stop FGM, let us try to take 90% of our children to school. That's the only time we will realize that we will stop FGM in one generation.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how have you found that other approaches have failed? Have you found especially as I mentioned in 2011, FGM was officially banned in Kenya. What other approaches have there been to try and curb FGM, and why have they failed compared to what you do?
Actually, you know, when the parliament passes the law to eradicate FGM in 2011, for me, sometimes I blame the Kenyan government, because they have not sensitized the community. The community didn't receive any civic education. And we know this thing is the culture of this community. And the government, they have tried to convince, jail them.
Wow.
But sometimes, you know, when you go to a family, and then the father and the dad, who will remain to cater for the kids? So you see, that's the thing now the government have also seen. So that's why main organization now, including Pastoral Child Foundation, we have decided that it's better we go door to door and meet, even if we hear that the girl will be circumcised. Let us go there. Let's talk with them. Let's go with the teacher. We sit down with the parent and of that child. We tell them about the effect of FGM because it's not their fault. It's the government's fault. They could first give out the fund to educate this community, because changing communities' culture, it's a bit different. So there is some techniques which actually they need to use. So it's like now the government, what they want to use the force to Samburu community, whereby we, as an organization like me working at the grassroots level, I don't actually like that. Because when we say that we are safeguarding this child, and the other way, we are actually, we are not saving this girls, we are making her to suffer. Because if you can take the parent to the court, then you leave those children alone. Who will cater for them?
Of course.
So the better way is to have dialogue. Talk. Tell them the fact. The community will change.
Often the problem seems to be largely in the wild, worldwide, especially at the UN level, the international community. There has been fewer countries now mm-hmm. performing FGM or have made it illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So almost at that international level, if you're then working with, say, the Kenyan government, it also feels that there's that pressure from international donors, the community,
mm-hmm.
to make the practice stop without really understanding the cultural context.
Yeah, actually, Charlie, for me, the person like me now working here at the grassroots level with the community, you know, I have an office here.
Mm.
When I use force, definitely the community will eliminate me. Two, what I'm using is do not harm approach to my community. I'm staying with this community. When I wake up early in the morning, I'm with this community.
Sure.
So the best way, we better, even if we say that in every month, let us change one family, that's okay. You know, change, it's better to be in a slow change than to use a force whereby that child will suffer. For me, my community actually, the one that we are working to eradicate FGM here, they are ready to receive me in both hands, because the way I'm approaching them, it's so welcoming to them. And I am proud to say that I have decreased in the areas that I'm covering. The FGM prevalence is actually going down, because I am in the fold of the religious leaders, the elders, to see how we can be able to tackle this in other in the way that community will not see that we are going against this culture. The community are ready to change.
Sure.
They are completely ready to change, but what they want is sensitization. They want civic education. But most of NGOs and the government, they are using force. And definitely, when you use a force to a certain community, things will not work.
You're more likely to
that's what
touch people in their
own viewpoints. That's why when you go back to hear the history of FGM, there are some organizations who have been starting to eradicate FGM in 1960s, but they have not changed anything. That's now, most of organizations prefer to work with the community-based organization at the grassroots level.
Sure.
Because it is better now, like the criteria that we are using here at Pastoral Child Foundation. In every village, we have change agent.
Yeah.
Even if it's at night, when the women come and stay in around, chatting, watching the stars, there is one change agent there. We will actually talk more about FGM. So some month ago, there is some power radio with FGM information using the Samburu language.
Yeah.
I've given to the community. So during the free time, the community will listen about the effect of FGM using the solar power radio.
Okay.
Yeah. So as the time goes, they will learn. They will learn. And that radio, it will not be in one village. I had 20 radio. Then I give 3 radio to every village. So when one family finish, they will give another family. They will give another family. That's the only way that we can be able to educate them, to give them the awareness about FGM and the effect. Yeah.
And could you talk me through the alternative rites of passage? Is this a formal ceremony in the community, or what does it look like?
Yeah, the rite of passage is like, let's say now we are circumcising a girl. That's a rite of passage from being a girl to a woman. So when we are circumcised, you'll graduate from being a child, from being a girl to a woman. So the rite of passage that we are using for girls is for them to have a declaration letter that when I will go home, I will educate my family members. When I go back to school, I'll make sure I've educated 10 more girls.
Okay.
So they have those declarations. And 3, they also say, I will not be cut. So they have that declaration cards.
And they can also say, I am now a woman by my own definition.
By my own definition, yeah, without being cut.
And that opens up so many other opportunities, yes, in education.
Yes. But the challenges also we are getting there, the community are using other techniques to circumcise the girls.
Yeah.
Some will take girls very far away to cut them. They are using also the midwife. So you see nowadays most of the community, like in Samburu community, sometimes they won't just have the ceremony to circumcise girls. They will even cut at night. So when people wake up, nothing has been done. So the girl will be there in the house for 2 to 3 days. The third day, he will just go. Mm. So those are the challenges that we have. But the change agent we have at the villages, they are the one to monitor those cases. Whenever they hear, for we are not supposed first to call the police. Because when you call the police, we will bring the conflict between the police and the parent and the girl.
Yeah.
It is we, PCF, Community Mobilized Online, to go and talk with the parent.
So you always hear about if the procedure's been performed.
Yeah,
it's kind of got
before the procedure. When we hear anything, we'll go and at least advise them. The dad will be there, the girl will be there. Maybe we'll go with the teacher. Then we'll start now educating them about FGM and the side effects.
Sure.
Yeah.
What's the future for Pastoral Child Foundation look like? What do you want to scale up or adapt your approach? What do you hope to achieve?
Actually, one of our achievements is to see a community free of non-FGM in Samburu community. And also, we are focusing to see 90% of Samburu girls and boys are in school. And one of our also focus, we have said that as we grow, we are also planning to see how we can be able to build the school for the community.
Okay.
And actually involve those parents from poor family ground to join the school freely. So you see, we are relating, you know, we are trying as a Pastoral Child Foundation to relate FGM, education, child marriage. Because without education, there is no way that we can eradicate FGM. Because there is no way that those girls will speak for themselves. We want to give these girls education. We want to empower them. We want to give them knowledge to speak for themselves. So that's one of our focus. Yeah.
They're almost like pillars. If you take away one of them, then the whole structure falls apart. If you don't have education within the community, you could have the other two strands.
Yeah, sure.
But then things can fall apart if you don't have other things to keep the structure up, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, sure. Because it's also a challenge. If now we can say we'll build the school and we don't have the money to pay the teachers, the workers, no, it's a bit challenging. So that's why it is now taking us too long to find donors to construct a school for the community. And also, it is so challengeable for us also to work within the community here without fund, because, you know, to reach the community at the grassroots level, you need a vehicle, you need a fuel. Actually, you cannot just go and take the community for the whole day without them having something like food to eat at the grassroots level there. So we have a lot of challenges in terms of fund. Currently now, we don't have a vehicle. The staff are not paid. So yeah. We are working for the organization while also we are trying to find other sources to keep our family, push on with life.
Okay.
So it's a big struggle now for we. It's a big challenge for we here in Pastoral Child Foundation. We are trying our best to see how we can get some more donors to help us eradicate FGM and promote child education in Samburu community and Maasai.
So that was a great interview by Charlie with Samuel Ladismo in Kenya regarding this awful practice of female genital mutilation and his work combating that. So thanks for listening, and check us out on the website, check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, everything we do. Tom, any final pitches why people, you know, tell people why they should support Humanitosphere?
I think the week speaks for itself. It's a week where we saw the New York Times, the NRA battling over what is true in a pair of ads, and a week when we saw Tom Hanks send an espresso machine to the White House press room with a note encouraging them to report on the truth. And we will continue to find the truth through independent journalism, and we need your support to do it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening. See you later.
Thanks.